Herod was granted clemency by the Roman governor of Syria, and he continued to increase his power. In 44 BCE, Caesar was assassinated in the Senate, and the Roman civil war broke out between Cassius and Brutus on one side and Mark Antony and Octavian on the other. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 62, Cassius, Herod, and the Lure of Power. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, the man for whom the play is named famously describes his dislike for one member of the Senate. Caesar says, "Yon Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous." To this, Antony responds, "Fear him not, Caesar. He's not dangerous. He is a noble Roman and well given." Caesar in turn tells Antony why he dislikes him so much. "I fear him not, yet if my name were liable to fear, I do not know the man I should avoid so soon as that spare Cassius. He reads much, he is a great observer, and he looks quite through the deeds of men. He loves no plays, as thou dost, Antony. He hears no music. Seldom he smiles, and smiles in such a sort as if he mocked himself and scorned his spirit that could be moved to smile at anything. Such men as he be never at heart's ease whilst they behold a greater than themselves, and therefore are they very dangerous. I rather tell thee what is to be feared than what I fear, for always I am Caesar. Come on my right hand, for this ear is deaf, and tell me truly what thou thinkest of him." There's so much to unpack in this small package, so much that illustrates why Shakespeare is not only a brilliant dramatist, but also a profound political thinker. And here, in analyzing these lines, I am drawing on the interpretations of the Shakespeare scholar Marjorie Garber in her book, Shakespeare After All. This is, of course, a description of Cassius' ambition, describing him as one who craves power, with Shakespeare adding a touch of humor for the audience assembled at the Globe, having Caesar say about Cassius, "He doesn't even like plays. What kind of a person is this?" Some people, says Caesar, are never at rest when they behold something, someone greater than themselves. Yet at the same time, Caesar tells us that while Cassius is a man to be feared, he is not afraid of Cassius, for in his words, "Always I am Caesar." We know this is a mistake. After all, Cassius is the conspirator who will inspire Brutus to kill Caesar in the Senate on the Ides of March. And Shakespeare in this passage also gives us an interesting metaphor for Caesar's failure to sense the danger. Caesar tells Antony, "Come on my right hand, for this ear is deaf," meaning one of his ears no longer functions. And the passage thus gives us the paradox of who Caesar is and will be. On the one hand, he will indeed always be Caesar, even dead. His body and his legend will inspire Antony and Octavian in their vengeance against the conspirators, and his spirit, great Caesar's ghost, will haunt those that rebelled against him. But on the other hand, his hearing infirmities are not only physical, but also an instinct. Marjorie Garber puts it this way, quote, "Always I am Caesar, this ear is deaf. The difference between bodily infirmity and mythic fame is also a difference in time and timelessness. Always I am Caesar. And this is a difference that Brutus will signally fail to take into account when he joins the conspiracy. Brutus should not be surprised that Julius Caesar is mighty yet, since Julius Caesar is a concept as well as a person. In the play, the mention of Caesar's deafness, a sign of his age, his weakness, and his unwillingness to listen to other people, is twice balanced by references to people who hear well." And she adds, "But Caesar's deafness is proverbial as well as physical. There was a popular saying that a king's left ear was for flattery and private favors, his right ear for truth and for public concerns, and his deafness is also, in some sense, a matter of political policy." End quote. In other words, the deafness is used by Shakespeare as a symbol of Caesar's political failing. He is a man so confident and so deaf to danger that he refuses to listen, to hear, to hearken to the warnings around him, and that was his undoing. This incredible passage in the play provides us with a lens with which to look at all that will occur in Judea in the next chapter of Jerusalem's story, a chapter that will involve some of these individuals, Antony, Cassius, and more. The man who continues to accumulate power in the region, Herod the Idumean, was indeed one with a lean and hungry look. Even if he himself may have liked plays and the arts a great deal, Herod could not tolerate one greater than him. And that meant that as long as the dynasty of the Hasmoneans was around, the members of that royal family should indeed have feared him a great deal. Yet, the high priest in Jerusalem, Hyrcanus, friend of Herod's father, seemed oddly unaware of all that he had to fear from this man, allowing him to marry into the Hasmonean family. And it is therefore striking that Hyrcanus himself ultimately had something happen to his ears, which, though not at the hands of Herod, was an injury that betokened more dangers from Herod yet to come. Let us briefly review the most important details of how Judean politics intersected with those of Rome in our story thus far. As we saw, two Hasmonean princes, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, contested for leadership in Jerusalem. Hyrcanus triumphed with the help of his friend Antipater, but this resulted in the bringing of the Roman Pompey into Jerusalem. Following Pompey's fall, Caesar was himself aided in Alexandria by Hyrcanus and Antipater, leading to the reconfirmation of Hyrcanus as high priest, but also to the installation of Antipater's two sons, Phasaelus and Herod, in positions of power in Jerusalem. Herod's own violence led to his summoning before the Sanhedrin, but thanks to Hyrcanus, he was allowed to escape. This brings us to the next point in our tale. Herod was granted clemency by the Roman governor of Syria, and he continued to increase his power. In 44 BCE, Caesar was assassinated in the Senate, and the Roman civil war broke out between Cassius and Brutus on one side and Mark Antony and Octavian on the other. Cassius arrived in Judea demanding funds for his war and was assisted in the raising of funds by Antipater and his two sons, or as Josephus puts it in a sentence that summarizes everything, quote, because Herod did exact what is required of him from Galilee before the others, he was in the greatest favor with Cassius, for he thought it a part of prudence to cultivate a friendship with the Romans and to gain their goodwill at the expense of the others, end quote. One Jewish aristocrat named Malichus, also charged by Cassius with the collection of funds, conspired against Herod's father Antipater and had him poisoned. Herod, as Josephus adds, quote, sent to Cassius and informed him of the murder of his father, who, knowing what sort of man Malichus was to his morals, sent him back word that he should revenge his father's death, end quote. Herod then killed Malichus, to the shock of Hyrcanus, who still did not seem to understand how powerful and independent Herod was becoming. Herod's unique ability to curry favor with the Romans was then made evident when the man he had already assisted, Cassius, was defeated by Mark Antony and essentially divided the kingdom with Octavian, with Mark Antony overseeing the east. Once again, Jews came before a Roman to fight over who should rule Jerusalem. Approaching Antony, there was on the one hand Herod and Phasael, the children of the murdered Antipater, whom Antony had known and highly regarded. And then there were other Jews who stated quite bluntly to Antony what they thought was actually occurring in Jerusalem. Josephus again, quote, the principal men also of the Jews came thither to accuse Phasaelus and Herod, and they said that Hyrcanus had indeed the appearance of reigning, but these men had all the power. But Antony paid great respect to Herod, who was come to him to make his defense against his accusers, on which account his adversaries could not so much as obtain a hearing, which favor Herod had gained of Antony by money. And Josephus adds, when Antony heard both sides at Daphne, he asked Hyrcanus who they were that governed the nation best. He replied, Herod and his friends. Hereupon Antony, by reason of the old hospitable friendship that he had made with his father Antipater, at that time when he was with Gabinius, he made both Herod and Phasaelus tetrarchs and committed the public affairs of the Jews to them. End quote. Thus, Hyrcanus the Hasmonean, with his friend Antipater dead, continued to vouch for Antipater's children, including the power-hungry Herod, who was made a tetrarch or a governor in Judea. Hyrcanus, Josephus further tells us, honored Herod upon his arrival in Jerusalem, placing a garland over his head, and allowed Herod to become engaged to his granddaughter, Mariam. But Herod's battles in Jerusalem were only beginning. While Hyrcanus's brother and rival Aristobulus was already killed, Aristobulus' son Antigonus, the nephew of Hyrcanus, led an assault on Jerusalem, allying with the old enemy of Rome, the Parthians. At one point, the Parthians deceived Herod and his brother, claiming to seek to enter the city only for the purpose of achieving a truce or an arrangement. Instead, they conquered Jerusalem, but Herod escaped with his harem and his men, first to Idumea, and then he took refuge in a fortress in the Judean desert, one whose name we know well today, Masada. Meanwhile, the Hasmonean Antigonus ordered the death of Herod's older brother, Phasaelus, and when it came to his Hasmonean uncle, Hyrcanus, he decided to give him a physical blemish, which would then, according to religious law, bar Hyrcanus from serving as high priest. Listen carefully to Josephus' words, quote, but being afraid that Hyrcanus, who was under the guard of the Parthians, might have his kingdom restored to him by the multitude, he cut off his ears and thereby took care that the high priesthood should never come to him anymore because he was maimed, end quote. Thus, we are left at this moment with Herod fleeing and Hyrcanus forever barred from serving in the temple as a priest. And thanks to Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, we now have a painful parallel to the play. Hyrcanus loses his ears long after he had already become deaf to the danger that was facing him, a danger that will face him again in the future. The greatest of political leaders have a sense of what is yet to come. The worst leaders can only construe what is right in front of their faces. It is Anthony who famously asked his friends and countrymen to lend me your ears and thereby turned the masses to him. But a leader must use his own ears, and Hyrcanus seemed absolutely incapable of doing so. Ultimately, the high priest who lost his ears ultimately lost his life at the hands of Herod, highlighting how deaf to danger he was. I recall reading somewhere or hearing in a lecture that in many schools today, plays such as Romeo and Juliet have replaced Julius Caesar, which was once common in the curriculum. And this, I think, highlights how we do not study works about politics and statesmanship as much as we once did. But it is only from the mistakes of the past that we can learn what is essential to successful leadership. In the play Julius Caesar, Cicero, seeing the omens of Caesar's death, comments, "Indeed, it is a strange disposed time, but men may construe things after their fashion, clean from the purpose of the things themselves." This, Marjorie Garber comments, is the mistake made by so many in the play, misconstruing what they see in their own fashion, blind and deaf to what is truly around the bend. This, in truth, is a lesson that Jerusalem's leaders during this time period committed as well. Leadership is a matter of hearing and hearkening, seeing of seeing and of vision. It is one that is all too rare in the history of the world, and why it is such a blessing when it truly exists. This episode is being released on Thanksgiving, and the original national Thanksgiving declared by George Washington in 1789 was meant to be an expression of gratitude to God for the Constitution, a work created by men of vision, one which endures today. I therefore, recording in the longest continuous democracy in the world, wish all of you a very meaningful Thanksgiving and look forward to learning together tomorrow.